All right, ready to dive deep. Today we're putting on our sociologist hats and exploring the world of the Bible.
Ooh, sociologist hats, I like it.
But not just any dive, we're going deep into the social structures and values.
Yeah, those hidden meanings and motivations.
We've got some sources on sociological criticism, and they talk about two main branches.
Okay.
First, we're going to be investigating the social background of those biblical texts themselves.
Sounds fascinating. What kind of stuff should we look out for?
Yeah, like what's the most important thing?
I'd say understanding that the ancient world, it was very group-oriented.
Group-oriented, okay.
Yeah, individual achievement, not such a big deal like it is today.
Right.
So your identity was much more tied to your family.
Oh, interesting.
Your clan, your community, the whole group.
That is interesting because so much of our modern world emphasizes, you know, individual accomplishment.
Absolutely.
But thinking about it with that group dynamic,
right,
makes me wonder if that's why some of Jesus' statements would have been so revolutionary.
Absolutely. Think about Mark 3.3135.
Okay.
You know, Jesus is there with his family and they're trying to pee him away.
Right.
But he points to his disciples and says, "Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother."
It's like he's redefining family altogether.
He is.
And in a culture where family ties were everything, that would have been, I mean,
yeah,
radical. I wonder what kind of reactions he got.
Oh, I know, right? Some raised eyebrows for sure.
Yeah.
And this emphasis on group identity, you know, it also helps us make sense of the household conversions we see in Acts.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
Remember Lydia, the businesswoman in Acts 16?
Yeah.
She becomes a Christian, and it says her whole household was baptized with her.
So it wasn't just about, like, an individual decision.
No.
But the entire household embracing this new faith.
Exactly. And even later on, we see Paul describing the church as a household in 1 Timothy 3.15.
That's a good point.
So it seems this concept of group identity continued to shape the early Christian community.
It's like that ancient value is still echoing through the centuries.
I think so.
Even in how we talk about the church family today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, besides this whole group dynamic, what else should we know about the social background of the biblical world?
Well, let's talk about honor and shame.
Ooh, honor and shame. Okay.
In the ancient world, Your Honor, it was like a precious commodity.
Hmm.
Tied to your reputation, social standing, even your safety.
Wow.
Avoiding shame was a huge motivating factor in people's decisions.
Okay, so if honor was like this social currency, how did that actually play out in daily life?
You see this dynamic throughout the Bible.
Yeah.
Take the parable of the prodigal son.
Okay.
The younger son's actions.
Right.
Demanding his inheritance, squandering it on wild living.
Yeah.
That would have brought immense shame upon his father.
That makes sense, especially in a society where, you know, everybody knew each other's business.
Right.
But the father's reaction to his son's return is even more fascinating. Throws a huge party, publicly celebrating his son's return. That seems like such a risky move.
It is, especially considering the shame the son already brought.
Exactly.
The father is already dealing with the shame of his son's actions.
Right.
And welcoming him back with such fanfare, he's risking even further judgment from the community.
So it's almost like he's saying, my son's restoration is more important than my own reputation.
Yes.
And that just adds a whole new layer of meaning to the story, doesn't it?
For sure.
And I bet this whole honor-shame dynamic probably sheds light on other parts of the Bible.
Definitely.
What else comes to mind?
Think about Jesus's interactions with the religious leaders.
Okay.
Those debates, they were often laced with attempts to challenge each other's honor.
So it wasn't just about theological disagreements.
No.
It was also about social maneuvering and power dynamics.
Absolutely. Like a verbal sparring match.
Yeah.
Where the winner gains social standing, the loser loses face.
And knowing that adds a whole new dimension to how we understand those encounters.
Right. And we see this honor-shame dynamic in some of the harsher language in the New Testament.
Like where?
Take Revelation, for instance.
Okay.
The author uses terms like synagogue of Satan to describe his opponents.
Right.
That kind of language, it wasn't just about disagreeing theologically. It was meant to shame them publicly.
Wow.
Damage their reputations.
So even insults had this deeper social meaning.
Oh, for sure.
Okay, we've talked about the importance of the group, the whole dynamics of honor and shame. Is there another key element of the ancient social world that can help us understand the Bible?
Yes, the patron-client system.
Okay, patron-client system. Break that down for me.
This was absolutely central to Roman society.
Okay.
Think of it as a web of relationships based on mutual obligation.
Okay.
You've got patrons. They're the wealthy and influential individuals.
Right.
And they provide benefits to their clients, who are often of lower social standing.
So it's kind of like a two-way street. The patron provides protection, resources.
Yes.
And the client provides loyalty and service.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds pretty complex.
Oh, well.
Like unspoken rules and expectations.
Yeah, and it wasn't just about material benefits either.
Really?
Patrons could provide access to social connections, legal protection, even political influence.
Wow.
Clients, in return, they were expected to enhance their patron's reputation.
Oh, interesting.
You know, through public displays of gratitude and support.
So how does this whole patron-client system, how does it show up in the Bible? Are there specific examples?
Oh, quite a few, actually.
Like what?
One that stands out to me is Paul's refusal of financial support from the Corinthians, as described in 1 Corinthians 8:10.
Okay.
Some scholars think he might have been trying to avoid being seen as a patron to the Corinthian church.
That's a really interesting point. It suggests that Paul was very aware of these social dynamics at play.
Uh-huh.
And trying to, you know, position himself in a way that wouldn't create misunderstandings about his motives.
Exactly.
So it's not just about money, but also about power dynamics and authority.
Right.
Yeah, very interesting.
And on the flip side, we see how the patron-client system might have influenced the Corinthians' tolerance of a man who was committing incest.
Oh, wow.
This is in 1 Corinthians 5.
Okay.
It's possible this man was a wealthy and influential patron.
Oh, I see.
And nobody was willing to challenge him because of his status.
So even in the church, those social hierarchies were hard to escape.
Yeah.
Makes you wonder how often those power dynamics were at play in those early Christian communities.
Right. And here's another fascinating example.
Okay.
The scholar David De Silva, he argues that the book of Hebrews actually uses the language of the patron-client system.
Oh, wow.
To warn Christians against being ungrateful towards God.
So, like, God is the ultimate patron, showering us with blessings and grace.
Yes.
And we, as his clients, were expected to respond with gratitude and obedience.
Yeah, it's a powerful way to frame our relationship with God.
It is. It makes you think about how much our understanding of certain passages can shift when we view them through that lens.
Right.
This deep dive is already making me rethink some of my assumptions.
I hear you.
Okay, so the patron-client system was pretty widespread.
It was.
Was it limited to individuals?
Mm-hmm.
Or did it play a role in the Roman Empire itself?
Oh, absolutely, woven into the fabric of the empire.
Okay.
Caesar himself was seen as the ultimate patron.
Wow.
Deserving gratitude and worship of his subjects.
Mm.
He provided peace, stability, prosperity.
Well, at least that was the narrative.
Right. And in return, his subjects were expected to offer their loyalty, even their worship.
Which, of course, created a massive dilemma for early Christians.
Yeah.
They were called to worship God alone.
Right.
But in Roman society, refusing to acknowledge Caesar as a divine patron, that was treason.
Exactly. That tension, you know, between loyalty to God and loyalty to the empire.
Yeah.
One of the key themes that emerges when we view the New Testament through this patron-client system.
This is fascinating stuff. We've talked about the group mentality, the dynamics of honor and shame, now this patron-client system. It's amazing how much we can uncover when we start digging into this social world behind the biblical texts.
I know, right? It's like a whole new world opens up.
What other social dynamics should we be aware of?
Well, one thing that often throws modern readers off is the ancient connection between kinship ties and character.
Oh, like in John 8.44.
Exactly.
Where Jesus says to the Pharisees, "You are of your father, the devil." Such a harsh statement.
It is.
But I guess in that culture, they believed a person's character was directly shaped by their family line.
That's right. They didn't have the same concept of individual personality that we do today.
Right.
They believed like father, like son was more than just a saying. It was a reflection of reality.
So when Jesus called the Pharisees children of the devil,
yeah,
he was making a profound statement about their true nature.
As he saw it, yes.
Wow. So not just a personal insult, but a statement about their spiritual lineage. That definitely adds a different layer of meaning.
It does.
It highlights how important it is to step outside our modern worldview and try to see things from the perspective of the original audience.
For sure.
It's like putting on a different set of glasses. allows us to see the text in a whole new light.
Absolutely.
So far, we've been focusing on understanding the social background of the Bible.
Yeah.
But I'm also curious about how modern sociological models can be applied to the text. Is that something we could dive into?
Absolutely. There's a whole world of fascinating theories and interpretations that emerge when we start applying those models.
Well, let's jump into that time machine and explore those models.
Let's do it.
I'm eager to see what new insights we can uncover.
Me too. All right. So, ready to shift gears a bit?
I'm always up for a gear shift.
We're going to explore how modern sociological models can shed light on the biblical text.
I'm all for a good model, especially if it helps me understand these ancient texts.
Right.
What kind of models are we talking about here?
Well, one of the most famous examples when it comes to the Old Testament is Norman Gottwald's peasant revolt theory.
Peasant revolt?
Yeah.
That sounds kind of intriguing.
It is.
What is it?
So Gottwald argued that ancient Israel, it didn't emerge simply through military conquest, as the traditional narrative suggests.
Okay.
But rather through a social revolution. An uprising of oppressed peasants against the ruling Canaanite elite.
So instead of a straightforward military victory, it's more like a grassroots movement for social change.
Exactly. Gottwald used sociological analysis to paint this picture of a society that was ripe for upheaval.
Interesting.
He argued that the economic exploitation and the social injustices of the time created the perfect conditions for this peasant revolt.
So that completely changes the way we might imagine that story unfolding instead of just focusing on like battles and military leaders. We're suddenly seeing the story through the eyes of the oppressed.
Yes.
The people who are longing for a more just society.
And that theme of social upheaval
and
that desire for change.
Right.
It's something we see echoed in other parts of the Bible, too.
Oh, like where?
Think about apocalyptic literature.
Okay.
Like Daniel and Revelation.
Those books are full of wild imagery and symbolism.
They are.
What's the connection to social upheaval?
Well, sociological analysis suggests that apocalyptic literature often arose from groups who were feeling marginalized, oppressed, even persecuted. They were experiencing a sense of crisis, whether real or perceived.
Real.
And they used this apocalyptic language to express their hopes and fears.
So it wasn't always about predicting a literal end of the world scenario.
Right.
But more about giving voice to the anxieties and aspirations of those who felt powerless.
Exactly. It's about understanding that social context in which these texts were written, recognizing how those conditions shaped the way people expressed their faith.
And I imagine that same kind of analysis can be applied to our understanding of Jesus in the early church.
Absolutely. Scholars have used these sociological models to explore all sorts of questions, like what was Jesus's role in society?
Right.
How did his message resonate with different social groups? Hmm. What were the social forces that shaped the growth of the early church?
Oh, that's a good one.
You know, lots of questions.
It seems like an endless well of possibilities.
Yeah, it is.
It's fascinating to think about how those early Christians navigated their social world while trying to spread this new faith.
It is.
Are there any particular theories about the early church that stand out?
One that I find intriguing is John Gager's theory about the role of veiled prophecies.
Veiled prophecies. Interesting.
In the spread of early Christianity.
Okay, break that down for me.
So Gager argues that after some initial prophecies within the early Christian movement didn't come to pass, they had to find a way to maintain that momentum and keep attracting new followers.
Okay.
So his theory is that they shifted their focus to evangelism. Spreading the message even more aggressively.
I see.
To compensate for those failed predictions.
It's like they were doubling down on their outreach efforts. To prove that their movement still had a future.
Right.
Even if those initial prophecies hadn't panned out.
Exactly.
It's a compelling theory.
It is.
A reminder that even movements with deeply spiritual roots are still influenced by social and cultural forces.
Absolutely.
Okay, this is all incredibly insightful.
Good. I'm glad.
But before we move on,
yeah,
there's one passage I'd love to get your take on.
Okay.
Through this sociological lens.
Okay. Which one?
It's from 1 Corinthians 11.
Okay.
Where Paul addresses some issues with how the Corinthians were celebrating communion.
Ah, yes. 1 Corinthians 11.
What do you think?
That's a passage that's often interpreted through the lens of, you know, individual sin and confession.
Right.
But sociological analysis offers a different perspective.
I'm all ears.
Well, it seems that the real issue might not have been unconfessed sin, but social divisions based on wealth and status.
Oh, interesting.
So scholars believe that during that communal meal, the rich and poor were essentially segregated.
Wow.
With the wealthy enjoying the best food
right.
and the poor getting the leftovers.
So instead of celebrating unity and equality in Christ, they were perpetuating the social hierarchies of the outside world within the very act of communion.
That's the picture that sociological analysis paints.
Wow. And Paul is calling them out.
He is.
He's saying, this isn't what communion is supposed to be about. You're missing the point.
Exactly.
It's a powerful critique.
It is.
Of how social injustice can creep into even the most sacred practices.
For sure.
It makes you wonder, are we truly living out that ideal of unity and equality in our churches today?
Good question.
Or are we still unconsciously replicating those same social divisions that Paul was condemning?
It's a challenging question.
It is.
That sociological criticism forces us to confront.
This entire deep dive has been mind-blowing.
I'm glad you're enjoying it.
I feel like I'm seeing these familiar passages with fresh eyes.
That's great.
But before we get too carried away with the wonders of sociological criticism.
Yes.
It's important to acknowledge that it's not a perfect tool.
You're right.
So play devil's advocate for a moment.
Okay.
What are some potential pitfalls we should be aware of when using this approach?
Well, one of the biggest risks is reductionism.
Reductionism. Okay.
It's tempting to think that those social explanations are the only Eile explanations for what we see in the Bible.
Yeah, I see that.
But that would be a mistake.
Okay.
We can't ignore the theological and spiritual dimensions of the text.
So it's not about saying, well, they were just products of their time.
No.
And dismissing the deeper truths the Bible might be conveying.
Exactly. It's about balance. We need to acknowledge that social context without reducing the text to a mere product of its time.
I hear you.
And we also need to be mindful that many modern sociological models, especially those developed in, you know, secular academic settings, can be anti-supernatural by nature.
So if we're only looking through a sociological lens, we might miss the divine element altogether.
That's the danger.
Okay, I see that.
We need to hold space for the possibility of God's action and intervention, even as we acknowledge the social forces at play.
What about the risk of, like, forcing a model onto the text?
Yes.
Just because a certain sociological theory is popular doesn't mean it automatically fits the biblical context.
That's a great point. We can't just take any trendy sociological model and slap it onto the Bible.
Yeah.
We need to be careful, discerning, ask ourselves, does this model actually align with what we know about the historical and cultural setting of the text?
Right. If it doesn't fit, we shouldn't force it.
Exact.
So it's about being critical and thoughtful, not just blindly applying models without considering whether they're actually appropriate.
Precisely.
Okay, that makes sense.
And another potential pitfall is that sociological criticism, like any method of interpretation, it's inevitably influenced by the interpreter's own perspective and biases.
So even though we strive for objectivity, we all bring our own baggage to the table.
We do. It's unavoidable.
Okay.
But the key is to be aware of our own biases, to approach the text with humility, and be open to the possibility that our initial interpretations might need to be revised as we learn more.
It sounds like a delicate balancing act.
It is.
But it also seems like sociological criticism can offer some incredibly valuable insights.
It can.
If used responsibly.
Absolutely. It's all about using it as one tool among many.
Right.
Not the only lens through which we view the Bible.
Okay. Okay, so we've talked about the potential pitfalls.
Yeah.
What about the strengths of this approach? What makes sociological criticism so valuable?
It can. Well, one of the biggest strengths is that it helps us to see the Bible in a new light.
Okay.
It forces us to ask questions we might not have considered before.
Like what kinds of questions?
For instance, how did the social norms of the time influence the way people understood God? Or how did those social structures shape the development of religious beliefs and practices?
Oh, I like that.
It's all about context, understanding the world behind the text.
So we're not just reading the words on the page, but trying to step into the shoes of the original audience.
Right. Seeing the world through their eyes.
Which is not always easy.
No, it's not. It requires us to challenge our own assumptions.
Right.
To be open to the possibility that our modern worldview might be coloring our interpretation.
It's like, you know, we need to take off our 21st century glasses.
Yeah.
put on some ancient ones.
Exactly. And sociological criticism helps us to do that.
It provides a framework for understanding the social, cultural, and historical context of the Bible.
And by doing so, it allows us to appreciate the text in a much deeper way.
It's like we're uncovering layers of meaning that were always there, but we just couldn't see them before.
I like to think of it as a kind of archaeological dig.
Ooh, okay, I like that.
We're carefully excavating the text.
Yeah.
Brushing away centuries of dust and debris to reveal the treasures that lie beneath.
So what kind of treasures has sociological criticism helped us uncover so far in our deep dive?
Well, we've seen how the ancient emphasis on group identity shaped the early Christian community.
Right.
We've explored the powerful dynamics of honor and shame.
Yeah.
And we've even seen how the patron-client system permeated every aspect of Roman society.
And how all of these things shed light on the biblical text.
Exactly, giving us a deeper understanding of its meaning and significance.
And even though it's not without its challenges,
sure,
sociological criticism can be an incredibly valuable tool for those of us who want to engage with the Bible in a meaningful and relevant way.
It helps us to bridge the gap between the ancient world and our own.
And to see the Bible not just as a collection of stories and teachings,
right,
but as a living, breathing document that speaks to the human condition across time and cultures.
And I think that's the real beauty of sociological criticism.
I agree.
It helps us to see the Bible as both ancient and contemporary.
Yes, that.
A text that's rooted in a particular time and place.
Yeah.
But also speaks to the timeless longings of the human heart.
This has been such an eye-opening deep dive.
I'm glad to hear that.
Sociological criticism has given us the whole new set of tools.
Yes.
For understanding the Bible.
And I hope it's inspired our listeners.
Me too.
To continue exploring the text.
Yes.
With curiosity and open minds.
That's what it's all about.
Absolutely.
Well, until next time. Happy diving, everyone.
Ooh.